I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking back at the first staging of The Plough and the Stars 100 years ago, and we'll be finding out why it provoked riots and furious debate. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Written by Sean O'Casey, The Plough and the Stars was first performed at the Abbey Theatre in February 1926. However, on the fourth night of its run, the performers faced a hostile and increasingly disorderly audience, outraged by what they saw as a grotesque distortion of recent history and a slur on the 1916 Rising. The protest included a coordinated intervention by some of the widows and bereaved women of the Rising. As the disruption escalated, W.B. Yeats intervened to defend the play, confronting the audience with the famous words, "You have disgraced yourselves again." Today, 100 years on, The Plough and the Stars is one of the most popular and performed plays in Ireland and is considered one of O'Casey's greatest. And so in tonight's show, we want to find out why the play provoked such fury and what the controversy tells us about the right of art to question national myths. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Nicholas Green is Emeritus Professor of English Literature at Trinity College Dublin and is one of Ireland's leading scholars of modern Irish drama. He's an expert on drama and theatre, especially Shakespeare, Synge, Shaw and modern Irish drama. And he's contributed a chapter on tragedy to the Cambridge collection of essays, Sean O'Casey in Context. Dr. Ciara Murphy is a lecturer in drama at TU Dublin and Vice President of the Irish Society of Theatre Research. An expert on performance, public space and social change in Ireland, she's the author of Performing Social Change on the Island of Ireland, From Republic to Pandemic. Dr. Bess Roan is a theatre theorist and lecturer in theatre at Villanova University in the United States, a leading expert on Sean O'Casey and the 1926 riots. She's the author of The Lines Between the Lines, and she has also been a director, stage manager and dramaturge. And I'm also delighted to welcome Mairead Delaney, the archivist at the Abbey Theatre Archive, and they have a wonderful archive there of over 1 million items from 1894 to the present, and you can access them by going to their website, abbeytheatre.ie. Well, you are all very welcome. And Bess, I might begin with you. And I'm going to go straight into night four in February 1926 and what became known as the riot and certainly the most dramatic of the controversies. What exactly happened?
That's an excellent question. And one of the things I think is very interesting is that much like the riots over the Playboy the Western World in 1907, what exactly happened differed depending on which newspaper account you were reading, whose diary you were reading. We have some letters that folks exchanged. But I can tell you that basically what we know happened is that a woman named Mrs. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington arrived with some friends who were all described by themselves as widows of Easter week. And they arrived. There had been some rumblings, as we know, on the second night. Wednesday, the audience was even a little bit louder. And by the time we got to Thursday, they're watching the play from the stalls and the orchestra. And all of a sudden, the soldier's song is being sung. People are talking back to the actors. We know Hannah Sheehy Skeffington herself was speaking back to the actors. And what's interesting is that eventually we get to a point where people get up on the stage. And in fact, it's women who get up on the stage, but also the first person up on the stage is a man. And this is really interesting because Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and the people she brought with her that night were all women. But men immediately joined in, which I think is fascinating because gender plays a larger role in this specific incident than it does in any of the previous Irish theatrical riots. It's women who are saying that, one reviewer put it, they were trying to vindicate the manhood of the Easter Rising men. Particularly, they were upset at how the men during Easter week in the play are not presented as heroes, as brave, as people who are running into battle. There instead are some, you know, less exciting and excited portrayals of people. Of course, initially, they don't say any of that. So they're simply screaming back at the actors. They jump up and then women are thrown off of the stage. We know that. And we know that the actors tried to close the curtain, but one man grabbed onto the curtain. And so he's kind of swinging with the curtain. And then people start hitting each other. We know this. An actor is punched. And then someone else throws this man off of the stage. The next account we have, people are throwing chairs onto the stage. So I'm actually quite glad that you used the word riot because there is a discussion about whether or not this is considered a riot. I think people got injured. So for me, that counts enough to say, yes, this was in fact more than simply a protest. This was a riot. So then, of course, famously, Yates gets on stage and actually I'm going to quote one of the two versions of his speech that's printed the next day. There are slight differences, but he is quoted as saying, quote, "I thought you had got tired of this. It commenced 15 years ago." He's, of course, referring to the Playboy there. "You have disgraced yourselves again. Is this to be an ever recurring celebration of the arrival of Irish genius? Once more, you have rocked the cradle of genius. The news of this will go from country to country. You have once more rocked the cradle of a reputation. The fame of O'Casey is born tonight. This is his apotheosis," end quote. So people at that point supposedly are saying, we want the play, but other people are saying, up the Republic. So there's sort of a general row happening. And the play continues, but it's being interrupted, basically. So that is the Thursday night kind of story that we can gather from the various sources. But again, they disagree with each other, depending on which newspaper you're reading. But we also know that that's not the last night that something happens. That's simply the first night that it goes from kind of murmurings into a full-blown event, if we'll call it that.
So, Bess, maybe a crucial point to get across is that this isn't just some spontaneous outpouring of anger.
Yes.
That this is a coordinated, choreographed protest to disrupt. Now, it does degenerate then into fist fighting and more of the riot element of it. But really, initially, it's more of a coordinated protest and a disruption.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that fascinates me about this. Is, you know, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, or maybe people don't know, she had some connection to the Theatre Francis, her husband, who was killed by British soldiers after he was arrested during Easter week. Actually, he was killed when he was trying to stop Irish rioters from looting Irish stores. And Hannah and Francis were pacifists until that event happened. And then she became even more politically involved. But although Frances had written a play or two, she's not a theater person. She attends the theater, but she isn't a theater maker, which is unusual because she did choose this event to stage a protest inside of the theater. So that's a really specific choice. And she does not go to stop the play. She actually simply goes to be heard alongside of it. And we know that because afterwards, she and O'Casey have this back and forth in the Irish newspapers. It's they're having this back and forth about what the point of the play is and when it should be staged. And both of them make clear that actually censorship is not the answer here. She does not want the play censored. She's simply saying, you have the right to do the play. I have the right to be upset about the play. And we're both exercising our freedoms here. This is too soon. A decade past the events is way too soon. And that's a really, really interesting argument. Because not only does she plan the actual protest, but she's also seemed to have planned her talking points in advance when people came to interview her about it. So she chooses the theater for this piece of political theater. She's not outside of the stage with a placard. She's in the theater. So yes, it is absolutely planned. And she's depending on a history of Irish riots to make this protest. I'm not saying she planned a riot, but she definitely knew that it was going to turn into something more than simply singing nationalist songs and talking back to the actors who were doing the play. So that's a fascinating difference between this and Playboy, which was not a single planned event that devolved. That was more of a spontaneous response.
Nicholas, the intervention of W.B. Yeats is one of the most dramatic parts of the story. And I think that's one of the most famous lines associated with Yeats. Mm-hmm. You have disgraced yourselves again. Although he's referencing the Playboy, it's 19 years and not 15 years, but maybe it's either, you know, not really remembered. He's not really bothering about doing the maths in his head when he's confronting all of this. But it is a dramatic and charged intervention.
It is indeed, and Yeats was sufficiently canny that he had the speech already prepared and had it off to the press, because there was no way that, given the state of the audience by the time he made his speech, that anybody could actually have heard him. But he was making sure that statement went to the press and was printed the next day. It's very much Yeats in full form. There's a wonderful cartoon of him back in 1911, I think, with him wagging his finger at the audience. It's what he really loved to do, was in full combat mode to tell them that they disgraced themselves again.
And Nicholas, what was it about Act Two that was the source of the offence, and why were they so upset?
Well, I think there are two things that are often mentioned. First of all, the presence of the tricolour in the pub. People said nobody would ever have brought the tricolour into the pub. In terms of the action of the play, the tricolour is the flag of the Irish Volunteers. But by the time it's performed in 1926, of course, it's the national flag. And this was felt to be a desecration of the flag to bring it into a pub. I've always wondered, you know, what did the men do? Did they park it outside? Was there, you know, somebody who, you know, could look after it while they went in for their drink? But the other offense of Act Two was the presence of Rosie Redmond, the prostitute. This produced all kinds of subsequent objection. Somebody was recorded as saying there was no such thing as a prostitute in the streets of Dublin. Well, Ria Mooney, who played the part in the first place, found out to the differ, because at the time the Abbey had no backstage. If you came off stage left, you had to go out into a sort of alley behind the theatre to get on stage right. And apparently the first night she went out in her full, you know, whore's get-up, she was accosted by the real-life equivalents who were out in the alley, who thought she was trying to intrude on their territory. So there were such people. But I think that basically what the objection was a kind of contamination of the sacred with the profane. In that act, you hear what were already famous words of Porrick Pierce coming through from the speaker behind, from the person who appears on a platform behind the pub. And these are kind of remembered snatches of Pierce's rhetoric. And at the same time, on stage, you have these quarreling Dubliners falling out with one another. You have a prostitute, and you have the flag, the sacred flag of the Republic, all appearing together. And I think it's that sense that what should be sacred is being contaminated by the profane, which is one of the things which the audience are rejecting.
Kira, I suppose today our sympathies are with the artist and the art, and we're more on the W.B. Yeats side of you're disgracing yourselves again. But I wonder, I'm trying to put myself into the shoes of the other people, and I think if you had lost loved ones in the 1916 Rising, and if this was such a powerful emotional event for you and a traumatic event for you and a sacred part of what became your national mythology, you know, maybe back then I would have been offended, and maybe if I try to see it from their point of view, you can kind of understand why some people were upset.
Absolutely. I think what O'Casey is attempting to do, I suppose, and taking that, what he, I suppose, thinks is a bird's eye view 10 years later, which is a short enough period of time, but it's also long enough to be reflective, is, I suppose, his argument is that he is attempting to, I suppose, highlight, I suppose, like the hidden histories that maybe the kind of like building of this national mythology and the whole idea of like the rising and what it became to kind of represent symbolically. What did that actually mean for kind of like everyday working class Dubliners who also did, you know, suffer losses during the rising, but maybe didn't attain the benefits or the sort of glory that those who were directly involved in the kind of more political aspects did? So I suppose going back to what Bess said about the actual events of the time, I mean, you have the widows and the mothers of those who were sort of martyred during the rising. Patrick Pearse's own mother is there. So it's an incredibly het up sort of environment. But at the same time, I have a lot of sympathy for Yeats in this one, in that what is O'Casey trying to represent? And Yeats didn't have that much sympathy for O'Casey's work, generally speaking, anyway. He wasn't always a fan. But what was O'Casey trying to kind of say with his work, and what was kind of missed then? So when we have this kind of coming to man intervention, you have Frank Ryan involved. He's trying to, I suppose, like feather his own nest in terms of kind of like attaining some more political relevance in that context. So the riot itself, and I agree with Bess, it is a riot. That's also a political intervention in a sense. That is also a kind of a propaganda move in its kind of moment. And again, what's lost is, I think, what O'Casey was actually trying to represent with the piece, which is what happens in the background, like what's happening on the ground. And is life better for these working class Dubliners than it was 10 years ago? And no is the answer to that.
And Bess, we sometimes see that in more recent times where there are these staged, choreographed interventions for plays where people are trying to make a point, whether a political point or a point about the environment. And it still happens today.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up, because, of course, I can't help but think of the recent No Theater on a Dead Planet intervention on Broadway for Ibsen's An Enemy of the People. So this was actually an interesting one, because it brought me right back to what I think Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and those folks were trying to do. And I completely agree with what everyone has said so far about the kind of complicated emotions and histories that are in that room. But also, they intervened at moments in the play, which made it clear that they knew what moments were coming in the play. And this happened very mindfully in this Broadway protest, where, of course, the play is already about environmental sustainability and the lack thereof. And when the protesters started there, people thought it was part of the play. And then the actors in character actually played with those protesters, which is different from what happened here. But in both cases, I think the stakes are very real. And the choice of going to the theater for those kind of protests is a very specific one. And yeah, I also have sympathy for everyone involved in this situation, because I do think that you know, there are a lot of different ways to handle history and also to handle the representation of history. So I think obviously the stakes are higher in the Plough and the Stars in terms of a personal loss than they are for something like environmental catastrophe, which is personal but feels larger in scale and somehow more removed from the individual. So you're absolutely right. And I think that this is not only a key event in Irish theater history, this is a key event in how theater interacts with society writ large in the English-speaking theater in the world.
And Bess, does a controversy like this help a play's reputation? And I'm thinking as well of Synge's Playboy of the Western World, that it certainly seems to make them iconic in Irish history.
It makes them iconic everywhere. I often say to my students, if you want everyone to see a play, you should definitely protest it. Because often, I mean, these Playboy and Plow, I would argue, happen to be quite good plays. But even throughout history, some not so good plays, if there is enough controversy, that ensures that people will continue to read them and perhaps try to restage them. And that is a very interesting after effect of having a controversy. So ironically, had Hannah Sheehy Skeffington not planned this, we have to ask ourselves what the role of The Plough and the Stars in the pantheon of Irish drama would be. I would like to think it would still be studied and it would still be done, but I bet it wouldn't be nearly as popular and kind of renowned as it is now. And I think in a certain sense, that's true of the Playboy as well. And again, that's not to say the artistic merits of these plays themselves are not good and interesting, but the fact that these events, that people felt so strongly about these plays, that shows their effectiveness very clearly. And in that sense, a riot is a time capsule. It shows you what people care about at a specific moment when they're responding to art, in this case, theater. And that is an incredibly powerful force that keeps these plays in the active repertory of Irish theater and also of theater around the world.
Mairead, the Abbey Theatre archive is really quite remarkable, and there are such incredible items digitized that you can look for, and they tell the history of the Abbey, but they also tell the history of Sean O'Casey's relationship with the Abbey and the plays that he's submitting, the plays that are performed, even in terms of how successful a play is and you know what nights it's making money and what nights it isn't and what periods they're doing well and when they're not. And you can really trace the popularity and the impact of his relationship with the Abbey.
You literally can. The documents are just fantastic for that. Literally, you're looking at the submission logbooks where you can see he has 5 plays rejected before his first one is put on. And that play comes in as On the Run, and we now know it as The Shadow of a Gunman. Then the next play is also turned down. And so by the time we get to Plough and the Stars, that's actually his 13th submission to the Abbey. And it's his 5th play to be performed, because people talk about the Dublin trilogy, which is a phrase he never used himself. He always talked about the 3 Dublin plays. And in fact, sometimes he talked about the 4 Dublin plays, including Tassie in that account. But there are other plays like Kathleen Listens In and Nanny's Night Out. So those are 2 plays that have kind of disappeared out of the ethos, but they still survive. They're there in the programmes. As you say, the ledgers, the financial ledgers are incredible. You can actually trace through the performance of O'Casey, starting off with maybe £90 for his first production for the takings, and working its way up to Plough and the Stars, where it's £434 for 6 performances. That was an absolute blockbuster. It was sold out in advance of the production. So that shows that Hannah Skeffington and the ladies who are with her have to have bought their tickets in advance. So it absolutely is a planned intervention. And that's just fascinating to see that.
That is fascinating to see it. And in terms of then the subsequent success of the play, like, was it something that was returned? We know that it went on to become this great, popular, iconic play that's so often performed. Did the success of it, combined with the controversy, mean that people were reluctant to return to it or wanted to return to it quickly?
Well, even during the week itself, there's a debate about whether they'll continue on into the second week, because the Abbey at the time is doing performances that run for 6, there's literally a week run. And the debate is, should they continue on the next week? Because there is advanced booking. People want to get in. They want to see the play. But Yeats and Lady Gregory decide, no, they'll continue on with what was scheduled and they don't come back till later in the year. And again, that builds up anticipation for the play. So, you know, it just ensures that there's always going to be a response. But just kind of going back into that week, everyone talks about that particular, the fourth night, the performance. But for me, there's great fun on the Saturday as well. There's an attempt to kidnap Barry Fitzgerald and two of the other ladies in the company to make sure that the performance can't happen. So there's people turning up at his family home with revolvers, trying to kidnap him, but he's not there. He's not living there at that point. So his sister and his mother are held hostage for a while. But, you know, it's that type of intervention. So the matinee is going ahead. They decide it's not safe to let the actors go home. So they have to stay. And we have a pianist from who's performing at the Theatre Royal comes over to give them an impromptu performance and gives them a concert while they're waiting in between. And that night then the reaction is utterly overwhelmingly in favour of the play, and O'Casey is called to stage so many times afterwards. So it's just interesting to see how it all plays out. But and again, obviously, you have all the intervention in the newspapers with Hannie Shee Skeffington and O'Casey. That's right. And then they come to a public debate on the 1st of March.
And this is Barry Fitzgerald, who goes on to have such an incredible Hollywood career and wins the Oscar for Going My Way. And he's in The Quiet Man and so on. So he's an incredible theatre performer, but exactly. And then also later an incredible film performer as well.
Incredibly so. And he's actually one of the actors who pushes the man off stage during the original riot.
So, Nicholas, when we look at the play then, and we look at, I suppose, as a complete work, as a whole, how significant, how great do you think it is? What is the genius of the play?
Well, I think it's an amazing play, and I think it deserves its popularity. It wasn't just, I mean, I agree with was best that it always helps to have a riot. It's something that the reviewers can always talk about when it's revived. But I think it earned its popularity by the fact that this is a deeply ironic portrayal of a great theatrical event. The Rising was Para Theatre, Murray Pierce coming out to read the proclamation, centering on the GPO. This is deliberately looking at that really important, iconic, historic event, as Kira was saying earlier, from the sidelines. Remember where the theatre is situated, just a street or two away from the GPO. Remember where those tenements are imagined, again, just around the corner. These are the people who are right beside what's taking place, and yet we're getting this very ironic view of what the ordinary people are experiencing of the rising. So I think that what it offers is this multiple vision of a historical moment, but seen not from the point of view of the leaders, not from the point of view of the heroes, but instead from the kind of prism of the various different sorts of people. And we have a remarkable range of political views in the theatre. The Covey, red-hot socialist, Peter Flynn, who's kind of old-fashioned nationalist, Clitheroe of the Citizen Army, and of course Bessie Burgess, mother of one of the soldiers out fighting for the British in Flanders. And I think it's that sense of what this whole group of people were, how various they were, and the way in which this is expressed theatrically, which it comes across so powerfully still.
Well, tonight we are talking about the staging of The Plough and the Stars 100 years ago and all the controversy that ensued. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll find out about the context to those riots. We'll find out about debates over editing or censoring the play before those first performances and lots more besides. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the first staging of The Plough and the Stars 100 years ago and all of the controversy that ensued. We have a brilliant panel of experts, Professor Nicholas Green, who's Emeritus Professor of English Literature at Trinity College Dublin, and he contributed a chapter on tragedy to the Cambridge collection of essays, Sean O'Casey in Context. Dr. Ciara Murphy, a lecturer in drama at TU Dublin and Vice President of the Irish Society of Theatre Research, who's the author of Performing Social Change on the Island of Ireland, From Republic to Pandemic. Dr. Bess Roan, a theatre theorist and lecturer in theatre at Villanova University and the author of The Lines Between the Lines. And Mairead Delaney, the archivist with the Abbey Theatre Archives. Ciara, let's talk then about the context to the play, the background, the lead up to the opening nights. And it's interesting the way something that was intended to be this subversive play and this attack on maybe some of those myths has actually itself become part of the myth around that era.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, it's interesting. O'Casey in the audience on that fortnight said he talked about the two plays that were ongoing, the one that was happening on stage and the one that's happening in the auditorium. And I think Plough has always been really good at sort of like broadening out that context when we think about what it is doing as a piece of art in its moment in time, but its continued relevance then and its sort of impact on how we view and commemorate the revolutionary period, you know, from that time, 1926, like right up to now, 100 years later. So O'Casey's representation of working class Dublin was intended to be a damning critique of the poverty of like the start of the early 20th century and the end of the 19th. And it's become kind of a regular litmus test, I suppose, for the state of the nation, appearing regularly at the National Theatre at significant commemorative junctures. But it has become, I suppose, it has suffered and become kind of almost like a heritage play in itself in terms of what it is kind of like sought to represent over time. And I think there's something kind of like relatively like natural about that when you kind of think about the context of like the middle of the 20th century. But I do think it's really interesting that something was meant to be this kind of like damning critique actually becomes like a stalwart of this kind of commemoration of this 1916 rising, which obviously O'Casey got a lot of flack for like in that kind of like immediate aftermath. So there's an irony to that, I think. And O'Casey wasn't anti-1916. He was anti the gap between this revolutionary promise and the reality of like working class life on the ground. So we have lost that in moments, but I do think that when we kind of look at the historical context, like particularly around the 50th commemoration, 1966, the politicians and the kind of commemoration committee at that time, they're like, we're not doing O'Casey. It wouldn't send the right message. So we've always been aware of the weight of Plough in terms of what it represents at these moments. And we can see through time, you know, in the 90s all the way up to now, the impact of that and how it has kind of sat against the history that it's trying to represent, but also the current moment in time that it is sitting within.
Nicholas, I was fascinated to read about all of the controversies in the lead up to the opening, the attempts to edit the play and the criticisms that people had that if this was the National Theatre, you couldn't have certain things being said or performed, and even some concerns that cast members had about particular lines.
There's a context here insofar as, in some sense, I think the riots over the Plough and the Stars are the kind of civil war pursued by other means, insofar as the Republican women that were mentioned are very much there to protest against the Abbey, which is then getting a subsidy from the government, from the Free State. But I think if we go back a bit, one of the conditions given by the government in terms of giving the subsidy was that there should be a government representative on the board. So George O'Brien, professor of economics at UCD, was appointed, and he read the script and was fairly shocked by it and thought it couldn't possibly go on. Very bad language, presence of a prostitute on stage, and so on. And Yeats and Gregory and Lennox Rumnd stood firm about Rosie Redmond had to stay, but they did accept that there should be some rewriting of the script, which O'Casey did. But what the actors objected to again was the language. F.J. McCormick, who was then the leading man, recently married to Eileen Crowe, both objected to the lines that they had to speak. McCormick, playing Clitheroe, had to say the word snotty, and he didn't want to do that. And Eileen Crowe would not play Mrs. Gogan because she had to refer to the fact that her children were all got between the borders of the Ten Commandments. This was shocking stuff. Both McCormick and Crowe were devout Catholics, and they objected to what was thought to be blasphemy. And so far did Eileen Crowe take her objections that she refused to play Mrs. Gogan. And it is said that in revenge, O'Casey wrote in for her the part of the woman from Rathmines, who gets caught up in the rising and keeps asking for directions back to Rathmines. And this was thought to be the right kind of genteel person for Eileen Crowe to play.
And Nicholas, George O'Brien is a fascinating figure. He contributed text to the Irish Free State Constitution, and then he's in this very awkward position as the government rep on the board. And is it the case that he followed this very kind of close line where he didn't want to go as far as some of the other people wanted in terms of edits, and that he was he kind of took a middle position on it?
Yes, I mean, he wasn't by any means keen to shut the whole thing down, but I think he was very worried about his position as the official government representative on the board, that he would be blamed, as it were, for what transpired. I mean, point of fact, as was pointed out earlier, I mean, the opening night was hugely successful, and you know, ministers like O'Higgins were there. I mean, it had plenty of support. But I think O'Brien, this was early in his days on the board, and he was quite worried that he would be seen as a government representative to be, as it were, sponsoring or okaying this scurrilous and scandalous show.
Murray, the archive has some wonderful primary documents for all of this as well, including the script changes that are marked and noted. And there's an original prompt script that they had, you know, in case someone forgot their lines. And so you can see what changes are being made up to the very last minute in the text.
Absolutely. But I'm actually going to take you right back to the beginning of the acceptance of the plough. It's submitted in August of 1925. And George O'Brien is present at a meeting in September of 25. It's his first board meeting, because they've actually kept him away from the board meetings. They've construed to keep him away. And he is finally kind of coming to this momentous meeting where they're going to discuss the plan starts. But what they do is they start off with a meeting where they start to corral the four people on the board, coming up with the voting rights to make sure that he basically was going to be cornered. So he could not have, he would never be able to sway the whole objections. He's also been fed quite a bit by Michael J. Dolan, who had been a director of previous O'Casey plays, but equally was really resentful of the part of Rosie Redmond. So he was having a word in his ear beforehand. But they conspire to make sure that there's 3-1, and obviously George is the dissenting vote, to make sure that the play would be accepted and any alterations in the play to be made by the producer. And of course, producer means director. And at that point, that was Lennox Robinson. So basically, they had already squared him off so he could. And they had also determined before the meeting that Rosie's song, the prostitute song, could be cut, but they weren't going to tell him before the meeting. So he could actually keep expanding. He kept saying, cut the song. So eventually they could concede to him, having already agreed to do though. So I think that's fascinating in itself. But looking at the prompt script, which it's a lovely piece of Abbey history, because it's the prompt script that was on stage the night of the Abbey fire on the 18th of July, 1951, when they're playing Plough. So I thought that was fascinating itself. But when you actually examine it, it is the rehearsal copy for 1926. And in it, you see O'Casey's amendments. And there's a cute, talking about the social history of the piece, we start off with Jack Clitheroe, and he's notated as being a clerk, a white-collar worker. But by the time they come to production, he's a bricklayer. He's a manual worker. So there's so much happening in that rehearsal room. And yes, the lady from Rathmines is a sap to Eileen Crowe, because O'Casey said he actually offered to pull the production if she wasn't going to be in the play. And the Abbey director saying, no way, an actor cannot have that amount of a voice. So that's where she gets that part. And of course, they're living in Rathmines at the time. So it very definitely is Eileen. And of course, she's delighted to play all those parts later on and move straight back into contention for all the bigger parts. But his intentions are very, very different. He has lots of people in mind. He's writing with F.J. McCormack in mind for the Covey. But Lennox Robinson basically is the one who determines the casting. And so all his suggestions are changed around. So he's already kind of having a bit of bother about that. But when it comes to some of the love scene in Act One, that was to be cut. That was to be kind of censored. And the song that was there that O'Casey intended to have was deemed to be too racy. And it's taken out. And instead they put in a music hall variety piece that everybody would recognise, the song Maggie, and they changed the name to Nora. So that piece, which has come down in Abbey history, is basically his second choice. There's so many little things like that you can trace through the prompt script.
And it shows how choices are made, decisions are made right up to the last minute, because something might have looked good on the page but just doesn't really work when you're rehearsing it. And so you're gauging it by the dress rehearsals and the practices, and you're always kind of tweaking it.
And that's exactly what happens with a new play today.
We're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll find out about the public debate between Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Sean O'Casey afterwards, and the legacy of The Plough and the Stars. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. And tonight we are talking about the staging of The Plough and the Stars 100 years ago and all of the controversy that ensued. Bess, I want to talk to you about, well, maybe your own career as a director, as a stage manager, as someone who studied at the Gaiety School of Acting here in Dublin, who brings classes over to the Lear Theatre in Trinity every year, and your own, I suppose, engagement as a theatre theorist. What's your insight into The Plough and the Stars and why it works and what makes it so great?
Oh, well, that's an excellent question. Thank you. And I just want to tie into what Marie was saying at the end of the previous section, which is, I have been lucky enough to be in the presence of that prompt script that she was speaking about. And the fact that it still smells like fire, I think, is a fitting kind of metaphorical place for us to be in this journey with this play. I was first exposed to the play at the Gaiety, actually. And I was immediately struck by, as this panel has been saying so correctly, the way that the average everyday person caught up in a historical event might behave, right? So I often think about theater from an embodied perspective. What does it mean to step onto a stage, to take someone else's words and speak them, but also live them for a short period of time in front of others? And that, I think, is the power and the controversy of this play, is that it's a little sacrilegious to have, you know, the martyrs of Easter week be just kind of regular people. And I understand this. I often say, from an American perspective, I say to people, imagine that there was a play about 9/11 in 2011 that was really kind of talking about all of the less than perfect and the complicated people who were not necessarily just heroes on that day. That would have probably caused a riot here. So I understand it from that perspective, but it is also a deeply rendered character study of these folks and a diverse array of folks that are not always represented in Irish drama, especially of this time period. So this play was one of my gateways into sort of being obsessed with this time period, the first kind of two, three decades of the 20th century, because of the combination of this really insightful writing and then an incredible audience response. And from admittedly an American perspective, I have always found it really admirable that the people who are watching these plays feel so, I don't want to say entitled, that's not quite the right word, but it is, they feel that their response to the theater that's happening in front of them, their response to the representation of their people matters and is part and parcel with doing the play, which is not an experience that we have in the US Although, of course, we have the Astor Place riots in 1849, which people are actually killed over, you know, riots over the representation of a play. But it's Shakespeare. It's not an American play. So this relationship between the people, the representation of Ireland, and the play itself come as a package. And for me, that's what makes this period of time so fascinating. And I think that Nicholas is completely correct that obviously the play is also excellent by itself, but you can't really fully divorce it from this response it evoked in an audience. And as a theater maker, as well as a theater historian and theorist, that effect, that's a measure of a play's power that you can't really ignore. So I'm fascinated in thinking about what it must have been like to be watching this play and to feel in an audience people's unease and to feel people's emotions start to shift into this moment of action finally on this fourth night in a large scale. That to me just seems so exciting. And obviously, I'm not pro people getting hurt, but I do think that caring so much about your representation is a very powerful thing. And actually trying to do something about it is also pretty astonishing and admirable on a lot of levels. So that's how I think about Plough sort of in a nutshell, I guess.
And Bess, it's very interesting that there's then this long conversation or debate between Hannah Shee Skeffington and Sean O'Casey in the newspapers afterwards. And what are they discussing? What are they arguing? And who do you think gets the better of that exchange?
Oh my gosh. Well, I will say I do want to read one of Hannah's first letters because I think it tackles a bunch of things that we've already talked about. This one is in the Irish Independent. And so Hannah Sheehy Skeffington writes, quote, "Your editorial misses what was apparent in your report regarding the Abbey Theatre protest. The demonstration was not directed against the individual actor, nor was it directed to the moral aspect of the play. It was on national grounds solely, voicing a passionate indignation against the outrage of a drama staged in a supposedly national theatre, which held up to derision and obloquy the men and women of Easter week. The protest was made not by Republicans alone and had the sympathy of large numbers in the House. There is a point beyond which toleration becomes more servility and realism, not art, but morbid perversity. The play as a play may be left to the judgment of posterity, which will rank it as artistically far below some of Mr. O'Casey's work. It is the realism that would paint not only the wart on Cromwell's nose, but that would add carbuncles and running sores in a reaction against idealization. In no country, save in Ireland, could a state-subsidized theater presume on popular patience to the extent of making a mockery and a byword of a revolutionary movement on which the present structure claims to stand. I am one of those who have gone for over 20 years to performances at the Abbey, and I admire the earlier ideals of the place that produced Kathleen Ni Houlihan, that sent Sean Connolly out on Easter week, that was later the subject of a British royal commission, the Abbey, in short, that helped to make Easter week, and that now in its subsidized, sleek old age jeers at its former enthusiasms. The incident will no doubt help to fill the houses in London with audiences that come to mock at those, quote, foolish dead, whose names will be remembered forever. The only censorship that is justified is the free censorship of public opinion. The Ireland that remembers with tear-dimmed eyes all that Easter week stands for will not and cannot be silent in the face of such a challenge," end quote. So I think she, first of all, that's a really good letter, I have to say. She really expresses herself beautifully. And O'Casey's, the first line of Casey's response is, quote, "A space, please, to breathe a few remarks opposing the screams and the patter antagonistic to the performance of The Plough and the Stars in the Abbey Theatre," end quote. And I think that sums up sort of the dynamic. O'Casey gets some really great points in and actually agrees with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington about, he validates her opinion and feeling that this is, you know, this is really something that's objectionable to her. He's saying, sure, yes, I agree. That's actually part of what I am saying, is that it's offensive that, as Nicholas brought up before, that we had these promises of freedom and how things were going to be better for the working class man. What has changed, actually? Because that's actually the thing that's making a mockery of these people. I'm not making a mockery of these people. So who wins? I don't know, because I do think that we get to a point where both sides actually have a ton of respect for the other one and are simply saying, we're not going to agree on this. Although I do think that, unfortunately for Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, she has not been correct in her her actual assessment of the art of the play, which she doesn't think is very good. But I do think that there's some personal opinion seeping out there that has not been borne out by history. So I think that people get points on both sides here, but ultimately there is no clear winner, except perhaps Sean O'Casey, in the sense that we still do the plow. And, we have not come down on the side of Hannah Sheehy Skeffington's objections. But I do think that she had a right to that opinion. So that was what was being aired in these letters for, you know, weeks after the fact.
Nicholas, it really shows the tension between the artist trying to challenge myths and to create something that is thought-provoking, and then those who maybe feel that it should be in the service of a national story or a national myth, and there can be a real clash and tension there.
Absolutely. I think what is the link to me with the Playboy, and I mean, I absolutely agree, Playboy is a different case. There it really was a completely spontaneous reaction of the first first night audience wanting to think well of the play, but really just were upset by it. And this was much more of a stage protest. But I think that in both cases, the other challenge is the form of the play. This is unlike the Playboy, the Plow and the Stars are unlike plays that the audience have seen before. And the first time you see a play that is as challenging and, in a certain sense, difficult because not expected as the Playboy of the Western World or the Plow and the Stars, people get upset. So there's a political context, but I think there's also a kind of formal theatrical context for this.
And Mairead, in terms of the archive, it means that you can have 100 years of records to deal with every single production. And even the fact that for the 25th anniversary in 1951, they're using the original prompt script for that production. It shows that, you know, we can tell the story of a changing Ireland as well by looking at these different productions of The Plow and the Stars.
Absolutely, we can. And there's stories to be told throughout that history. For me, O'Casey is writing with a real immediacy for the actions. If you think about, you know, Shadow of a Gunman or any of those plays, they're only within 2 years of the action of what they're portraying. So Plough, you know, has a distance of almost 10 years for him. That's quite extraordinary. But yet we would consider that to be just a short timeline. And yet in his exchanges with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, he defends himself at one point, and I love this particular piece in the newspaper where he's talking about the drama is his place for self-expression. And he claims the liberty in drama that they enjoy on the platform, and I'm prepared to fight for it. So O'Casey, who's, you know, this pacifist, is actually saying, well, I'm going to stand for this. This is my means of expressing myself. And I do think theatre can do that for people.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Nicholas Green, who's Emeritus Professor of English Literature at Trinity College Dublin and one of Ireland's leading scholars of modern Irish drama, Dr. Ciara Murphy, lecturer in drama at TU Dublin and Vice President of the Irish Society of Theatre Research, who's an expert on performance, public space and social change, Dr. Bess Roan, theatre theorist and lecturer in theatre at Villanova University in the United States, and Mairead Delaney, the archivist at the Abbey Theatre Archive. And the wonderful archive there can be accessed at abbeytheatre.ie. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. I hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.